This is Robert Stark. I am joined here today with Alex from Academic Composition. Hey, Alex.
Hello.
So, tell me a little, I guess we can start off, is what gave you the idea to start up Academic Composition?
As you may have guessed, and as anybody else familiar with this business may have imagined, nobody plans ahead to fall into this business. Rather, what happens is a result of events that you're not planned for. And essentially, academic ghostwriting is an economic necessity that results due to the colossal failures of the market. So what we have here is a surplus of graduates with humanities degrees that are essentially worthless in the job market. And college students who obtain these academic credentials see no choice but to enter this field, provided they are qualified. And I got my degree in philosophy, so I learned some basic academic writing skills and then calculated them further to enter this field. So it's really a fortuitous event that I could not have foreseen before entering this field.
So I guess you did put your philosophy degree to work. I guess a lot of people who are getting those degrees are not finding work.
Yeah, I did put my philosophy degree to work, but certainly not in the manner I expected or hoped. And that's true.
So you've been doing this for about 5 years?
Yeah, on a professional full-time level for 5 years, but I've been getting by for college, writing papers for my classmates, I've been making some cash on the side since I was 19. So essentially, I've been doing this for almost 10 years, but this has been my full-time job since 2009. So it's been 5 years since I started making a living this way.
So you're saying you started when you were in college?
Exactly, yeah. When I was a freshman in college, I began picking up a few assignments from my roommates and classmates, and I got further into it my sophomore year, and by my junior year, I was already in a position to begin writing on a frequent basis. By my senior year, I was already doing this full-time.
And I guess you probably get a lot of people saying that what you do is ethically or morally wrong, but your response to that is that the system itself is immoral, so you're not necessarily doing anything immoral yourself. Is that what you would probably say to those people?
Yes, the principle that I strongly believe in is that we all have a moral obligation to obey legitimate authority and to disobey illegitimate authority. The system of education has forfeited its right to lecture us on what is moral and what is immoral. They have reneged on their responsibility to educate the public. They're just indoctrinating the students. They're committing rampant consumer fraud by equipping students with degrees that are worthless, and their marketing campaigns are predominantly duplicitous.
And you're Russian. I think I've noticed that Russians generally have a much more cynical view towards things. A lot of sort of Anglo-Americans, they have this kind of mentality that even if the system is rigged, you still have to kind of play by the rules and respect society, even if it's rigged against you.
Yes, there is one fundamental difference between Eastern Europeans and Western Europeans and North Americans. I grew up back in the collapse of the Soviet Union and its immediate aftermath. I still have memories of the red flags coming down everywhere when I was 3 or 4, and the whole country was ransacked by the crony capitalists and the mafia. Although the teachers taught us that we should respect authority, that our predecessors were wonderful, that we should revere the soldiers who died for us, even the kids my age, when we were 5 or 6, we were all very well aware of this was absolute nonsense. It was common knowledge that the cops were corrupt, the teachers were corrupt. In fact, the earliest memory I have of this is that Teachers' Appreciation Day in Russia. where the teachers and the principal compose the comprehensive list of gifts they wanted to receive for that day. And many of these gifts, you know, $500, and that was a lot of money for somebody living in the post-collapse, post-USSR Russia. And it goes without saying that the parents who have submitted the most effective, the most expensive gifts are the most likely to see their children do well. And I've noticed the similar mentality is common in countries that have also undergone an economic collapse. And another good friend of mine is from Argentina, who lived through the collapse of 1998 or 2001. And what we agree on is that when the system is rigged, when the officials don't walk the talk, when they do not deserve our compliance, illegitimate authority is to be frowned upon, it's to be subverted. It is not to be dignified with passive compliance.
Yeah, and I don't. I mean, I basically have almost zero, very little respect for the American academia. Basically, what's happening is, first of all, if you want to make it into the middle class, it's basically a prerequisite that you get a college degree. But you get these kids; they're paying. They have like $100,000 in debt, most of which is going. Most of which of that debt is going to bankers. Then on top of that, you're getting basically indoctrinated. You have to be indoctrinated by all these cultural Marxists, and you have all these different like bullshit degrees, different things like all you know the classes like the women's studies classes and ethnic studies and all that stuff.
Well, this is not news. However. We have observed a fundamental paradigm shift in our system of education since the 1950s. As you may well be aware, college used to be restricted to the students who are quite ambitious, open, intelligent, and driven to make the best out of themselves in intellectual respects. That was in the 1950s, when maybe 10% of the population had the privilege of obtaining a degree. And the indoctrination was left for high school. But now, college is obviously the new high school. College is the propaganda camp, is the rigorous, intensive indoctrination campaign for the youth. And I remember the other day I was talking to another acquaintance of mine from Malaysia who was asking me questions about life in America. And then once, and finally, he got around to asking me about the system of education in this country. And I told him, well, you know, it's like intensive obedience training camps. And he says, What? I thought that obedience training is for dogs. And I said, well, yes, that's true. But the relationship of a student to the state in the United States is really not that much different. The student here is simply an embodied commodity to be exploited by the elites, and this idea, this was even observed in the 60s when Mario Savio, at the famous Berkeley protest, delivered his Sprouts Hall speech, where he protested against the students being treated like cogs in a machine, and that speech is very famous about dismembering this machine. And so on. So the basic idea that the students are embodied commodities is nothing new. But what is truly disconcerting is that this mentality is becoming much more common. Virtually all universities now function in this manner. You'd be hard pressed to find one that does not fit this model, and it's only going to get worse, from what I can see.
So, what purpose do you see that a higher education should serve society?
I think that any bureaucrat from the dean's office at Harvard or a typical 4-year university will be well equipped to answer this question. And I'm sure that if you ask him that question, he will say that the university should teach people to become better citizens, empower them to think critically, enhance their intellectual capabilities. And of course, enable them to become more productive in the market. So really three things, civic duties, intellectual achievement, and productivity. And the universities simply fail to deliver with respect to all three. And it's been quite a colossal failure.
And I mean, if there's also a difference, I mean, there are d- degree, there's like STEM degrees for people who are good at like say math and science, but especially like the anything with like a English liberal arts degrees is what your stuff like liberal arts or the humanities and stuff like that.
Well, I wouldn't single out liberal arts and the humanities, although that's certainly part of the problem and it gets into the category you described. There are many other degrees that are completely useless. Suppose that you have a degree in plain mathematics. Well, that means you just have a basis to become a good engineer. You have the potential to cultivate marketable skills, but as it stands, that degree is useless. Will any dean tell you this? If you go to your advisor, your career advisor, your class counselor, will he tell you that? Absolutely not. Essentially, my point about that is that the university is guilty of consumer fraud. At the very least, they should publish a disclaimer that if the student chooses to specialize in an academic discipline that's not marketable, he should not expect to earn above the national average. Yet the university is thoroughly conceal these facts, and when they publish any kind of information on this, they're quite evasive and vague. In fact, I once asked my advisor about what I can do with an MBA degree, and he walked out. He sat down for a moment, and then he got up and left, saying that if he tells me something that's incorrect, I might sue him. And nobody ever gave me any kind of useful information, and now I see a reason for that.
What degrees specifically do you see as being the most useless?
Most useless degree, I would say, cultural studies. And I've had a student who was working on a PhD in cultural studies and just classes on tourism. That's right. So I had to write a 10-page paper on tourism in Granada, I believe, and another follow-up paper on the cultural values and habits of the Cameroonians. Of course, the cultural studies is certainly a candidate for that title. I don't know if it's the most useless one, but that's one that immediately comes to mind.
And the thing with the academia is originally the purpose of academia was to educate and prepare skills. But the problem is it's a whole industry, it's a whole business industry where you have, as I said, the money where students are taking out loans, and that's enriching the bankers. But then you have all these bureaucratic positions, all these overpaid positions. So the whole concept of education is to milk the students for their money as much as possible instead of to educate them and give them the skills that they need to make it in society.
Yes, essentially that's the case, and this is the fundamental consequence of any crony capitalist system. Imagine what our system of education would have been like in the UN, where the universities truly have to compete for the favor of students. At the very least, the universities would have been forced to provide the students with the kind of education that the students deem to be important. And then, for example, such a university probably encouraged the students to major in the STEM field, probably discouraged them from pursuing something that's complete flop and pablum. And the universities that would fail to provide the students with the product they desire probably go out of business. But here, the universities make munificent donations to their political candidates. They lobby extensively. And in return, the government reciprocates by providing students with grants and loans that invariably drive up tuition fees. The way this works is rather obvious. If the students cannot pay what they're asked to pay and there are no loans and grants from the government, well, then the university obviously has to lower its prices. But since they collude with the government, the university is now in a position to bury students deeply in debt, so they can then pay the tuition they cannot afford. Ultimately, the university does not answer to the consumer, and that's the problem. That's one of the key issues plaguing our system of education today.
What role do you see the K through 12 system having in regards to providing like practical skills in things such as communications, basic math, and reading and writing?
Well, that's obvious. The K through 12 should provide these skills, but their capacity to do so is deteriorating, it's diminishing. I don't think you need to go very far to find a sixth grade student that can barely read. In fact, when I was a college freshman, that matter, I had roommates and I had friends who made at least 20 grammatical errors in one sentence. I don't know what's going on here, but I would guess that perhaps insufficient funding is the issue. But even in schools where the funding is excessive, the teachers simply have no incentives to provide students with the service they require. Obviously, the teachers' unions provide teachers impunity from scrutiny by the teachers and the parents, and that's a problem. I think that the K through 12 system shares the same fundamental problem with the university itself. In other words, the operatives of both systems do not answer to the consumer sufficiently. They simply do what they want to do because they're colluding with the government, and that needs to change before we start seeing any kind of a realistic and a substantive reform take place.
And what are some of the reforms that you would like to see in academia that could make it work?
Well, I think we need to start on the K-12 level, and Milton Friedman had the right idea about this. I believe that he was one of the intellectual founders of the concept of the voucher system. If we're still going to be funding the schools with the taxpayers' money, and I think we should give the parents the liberty to decide what school their children should go to. That's step number one.
Are you talking about vouchers?
Yes, exactly. So this is a midway point. I mean, privatizing schools and keeping them under the control of the government bureaucrats. So that's the first thing I recommend. The second thing I recommend is essentially eliminating the government grants and loans. The reason why this will work is that it will lower the tuition prices, the tuition fees, but then. The students will actually have more of a say in what and how the schools operate. If nobody can get loans, then the students must pay their own way for college. They'll obviously be much more careful with their money. Not everybody will be able to get their parents to pay. Not everybody will be able to find a lucrative job that will finance their enormously expensive education, so the students will then earn the value of the dollar, because everything they pay will come straight out of their pocket. And at that point, when students cannot afford to go to school anymore, the universities will really begin making more of an effort to provide them with the kind of service that the students require. They won't be able to do whatever they please just because everybody can go to college.
And the other thing is, I mean, it used to be having a college degree was like a guarantee to the middle class. The value of a college degree has been diminished so much.
Yes, and then the solution I'm recommending appears to be quite relevant to this issue. Well, if we have too many people with degrees, how do we solve this? That seems like a no-brainer. Why don't we make it more difficult for people to get degrees? And then the best way to do that is to cut off the supply line. Eliminate the resources that enable students to access the fund that let them go to college. And yes, there will be leftist protests, there will be demonstrations and allegations that this is a fascist move, that this is all a Republican conspiracy that regards ignorance as virtue, yada, yada, yada. And you duly noted, but the issue here is that most of the degrees that we get are not relevant to the job market. In fact, anybody can look up some basic statistics on how many students actually work in the field that is relevant to their degrees. As a matter of fact, I remember writing a paper on this issue 5 years ago where I had to summarize the book on the book that was supposed to help students pick the right major and transition from learning to earning. And there, the author unabashedly said that the very idea that you should major in what you're going to do for a living is arcade. That's the exact word she used, and it's arcade because this idea goes back to 1909. Well, that was the time when most people indeed majored in what they wanted to do for a living. But now about a third of students do that, and most of these students who actually do what they majored in are in the STEM field. What about the other two-thirds? Well, they work the kind of jobs they could probably get into without any academic training whatsoever.
So I guess I'll ask you about the people who contact you for writing. Would you say that the majority of them are either lazy or are not academically or intellectually qualified for college? What percentage of the people who contact you fit that category?
It's difficult to put a pure number on it, but I would say that a significant percentage of these students really are not qualified to be there. At least 40%, but at least this is true for 40% of the students. Yet again, it's hard to say that even those who seem like they're not qualified really aren't qualified, because the majority of the students are employed, and many of my clients are employed full-time. So for all I know, if these students had more time to spend on their assignments, their writing would have improved a lot. And then that's yet another issue we've got to ask. Why is it that so many college students are not qualified to do academic work? Is it because we as a nation are getting dumber, or is it because the college students simply are not in the right position in their lives to calculate academic skills? I think it's too complicated of a question to be answered in this discussion.
And you also get people who are, especially older people going back to college, who have to get a specific degree, but they're too busy with their work to get the papers done.
Yes, in fact, this demographic group comprises roughly 40% of my clientele, and these are the people who usually become recurring customers because they can afford to use this service on a regular basis. Typically, college kids don't have the money for it, or they're too immature, or they're too disorganized, they're just a headache. But the working professionals, they're the backbone of any academic ghostwriting organization, because these are the clients that I want to target aggressively, and I always depend on them to stay afloat. In August and December and May, or other times of the year when most conventional students are out of school.
And you also get a lot of foreign students who are, a lot of them have trouble like understanding things that are in English in many cases.
Yes, that's true about a lot of the foreign students, and many of them are actually affiliated with foreign governments. I encounter many students of this variety because I live in the D.C. area. In fact, my favorite example is a student from the Mongolian embassy who did not write a single coherent sentence. She was getting her master's degree in public administration at Strayer University, which is a very well-known degree mill. And then I asked her what her bachelor's degree was in, and she did not know what I was talking about. Well, I can only hope that the reason she didn't know what I was talking about is that she didn't understand enough English to know what a bachelor's degree was. And then hopefully she got her BA in Mongolia, but I really don't know, because that person did not seem well-educated at all.
And the papers you write, are they unique papers? Because I know they have this program at universities where they can run a paper through like a background check and find out if there's a duplicate online somewhere. So do you write each paper individually, or do you reuse them?
I never reuse papers. In fact, this is the whole reason why the essay writing business is such a flourishing enterprise. In the late 90s and early 2000s, professors discovered the Turing-Yen program, and they naively paraded that as a solution to all their academic woes. They asserted that somehow this will end all plagiarism. But the students were one step ahead of them. They hired people like myself to write original papers, and now there is simply no way for them to get caught unless they confess. But so far, not one of my clients has been stupid enough to confess.
And what are your thoughts on the online degree mills like DeVry and Phoenix and Kaplan?
I think this is the future of America. This is the future of our system of education. Most four-year institutions are becoming increasingly similar to these degree mills. And I know this for a fact because the quantity of online programs with the four-year institutions is increasing dramatically. The ratio of degree of online classes to traditional classes is increasing precipitously, and that's not going to change. What is the problem with these online classes? Well, that's very, very simple. For one, it's much easier to cheat through them. All the student needs to do is go log into their student account and send over the material to the writer. And some writers are even willing to log into the class and do it from start to finish. And many of my clients ask me what I'll charge for doing their whole class. But I'd rather not do that because it's too complicated. The classes are very, very poorly organized. The professors are completely, completely feckless and irresponsible. If you go to a school like the University of Phoenix, you'd be quite surprised to see that there are no PhDs there practically. You'd be hard pressed to find any professor with a serious track of academic publication or even teaching credentials. So not only are the online classes easy to cheat through, the people teaching these classes are often quite incompetent. And the students are even worse. If you want to find an illiterate student, you'll find plenty. If you just log into an online class, it's Strayer, Ashford, DeVry, Kaplan, and so forth.
And another thing you say about academia is it's has a purpose of churning out basically docile employees for the corporations.
Yes, and then that is the sentiment that Mario Savio famously condemned. Back in 1962, but even then the problem was not as severe as it used to be then, as it is now. Sorry, and the way this works is quite simple and straightforward. If you get a job at a government bureaucracy, you're probably not going to need to be a sophisticated thinker unless you get to the highest levels. You just follow protocols. You do what's expected from you. You don't upset the apple cart. And that's what you can expect in many transnational corporations. On the other hand, if you start a small business, or you get hired by one, or you become one of the essential members of the organization, you will need to display ingenuity, innovation, critical thinking abilities, and initiative. Yet again, small businesses are not going to get bent out of shape over the fact that you don't have a college degree. That they want to hire people who are competent. On the other hand, competence is much less of a priority for a bureaucracy, where virtually anybody can follow the monotonous and routine-like guidelines that are imposed upon the docile chattel that's being manufactured by the ivory tower.
And you say that there's a collusion between the nation's biggest employers and educator. So it basically turns out morally and intellectually deficient individuals who will stop at nothing to climb the corporate ladder or any other prevailing hierarchy or bureaucracy. And that basic people you're saying have little, that it doesn't really teach them any other values other than that.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, famous contemporary psychologist Kevin Dutton argued that our society is becoming increasingly psychopathic. And that means that we're becoming less in tune with our values, We're now less aware of who we are and what we want to do with our lives. We're now much more driven by the profit imperative. And our universities are marketing, working for the corporations as the best strategy for obtaining for the financial results that we desire. And I'm sure you're familiar with various online commercials from the University of Phoenix, where they just come right out with it and say that if you enroll in the University of Phoenix, you will be able to meet up with representatives of this or that corporation, and that's your key to working for the corporation. Then this trend started back in the early 70s, about 10 years after Mario Savio's famous Sprout Hall speech. There was a series of facts, a series of studies showing that the students' collective attitudes are shifting. They're becoming less and less interested in developing a coherent philosophy of life and more interested in working for the corporations. And in fact, back in the 1950s, there was a comprehensive survey asking students how much they want to build a coherent philosophy of life. And then at least 8 out of 10 said that this was very important to them. On the other hand, well, one or two would say that becoming financially well off is important today. This trend has been reversed. The overwhelming majority of the students now say that they would much rather be better off financially than to form a coherent philosophy on a philosophy of life. These trends continue to exacerbate at a very alarming pace.
And in regards to the academic ghostwriting, what do you see as being, what's greater, the demand for the academic ghostwriters by the students or the supply of the services of the academic ghostwriters?
Competent academic ghostwriters are very difficult to come by. Not because essay writing is difficult, but because it is a very tedious and a time-consuming ordeal. As we discussed earlier, the universities are now producing docile shadows, or students who merely follow directions. So if you want to become a good academic ghostwriter, you can forget all about achieving intellectual growth or becoming more creative or even learning to think outside of the box. You'll be severely chastised for that. So what you want to do is just follow the instructions very thoroughly, put in the time, don't question the authority of the professor, no matter how absurd, preposterous, or asinine the material may be, and just plow through it, knuckle down, and keep on trudging. That's the way to be successful in this racket. And obviously, this is not a job for a human being. This is not something that many people are going to be thrilled about doing, regardless of how much it pays. So, for this reason, most competent ghostwriters are overwhelmed. In fact, I have never run out of work since I began doing this full time. Even in August, when most students are out of school, I still have plenty to write. The only time when I can take a break is mid to late December, when most students are on the Christmas break. But even then, if I really wanted to, I could probably find some more degree mill customers.
And you may kind of make a comparison. You talk about this event in 1970s in Italy. Right-wing radicals staged massive terrorist attacks to bring attention to raise public awareness to certain issues in Italy.
Yes, essentially, Italy was polarized at the time as many European nations were. Italy has undergone a fairly similar event to the Spanish Civil War during Franco's reign. And the right-wing conservatives in Italy had a very similar attitude to that of our neocons. Meaning, they were very much concerned with the declining morality of the nation. They believed that Italy was weakened, and they were humiliated by the outcome of the World War II, where it has become painfully obvious that the Italians were incapable of fighting any modern war. So what they wanted was a stronger government with a more distinct nationalistic purpose. And the way they wanted to achieve that is by raising the public's demand for such a strong, bellicose government. They did this by staging terrorist attacks to prove that that the government was not capable of responding to foreign terror, even domestic terror. And then this method is known as a strategy of tension. Now, there are several conspiracy theorists that, in fact, accuse the Bush administration of implementing a strategy of tension by purposely bombing the Twin Towers. Now, I don't want to get into that. I don't know if these conspiracy theories are true. I'm not advocating violence. But what I'm saying is that we can implement a variation of the strategy of tension in our system of education.
So what you do is not, I mean, it's a business in a sense, but you do view it as a political cause as well.
Yes, but I just want to be very clear about this, that I'm not Mr. Stewart. I'm not advocating campus radicalism. I'm not claiming that we need to harm anybody physically. What we need to do is expose the weaknesses of our system of education by showing that it truly is not capable of combating plagiarism. And academic ghostwriting is a strategy for bringing this issue to light.
So, before I wrap things up, is there anything else that you would like to add about either the ghost writings or the issues having to do with academia?
Well, I think this is the time for an awakening. This is the high time when we as a student body, we as the citizens need to wake up to the reality of the deterioration of our system of education. It's not 1962. America's best years are behind here, and there is really nothing we can do to turn the clock back to the time when getting a college degree was a ticket to the middle class. We need to call for a comprehensive reform of our system of education. We need to stop patronizing the degree mills and begin thinking about what we really need to do to become productive citizens. And if the system of education does not provide us with the resources that we need for this purpose, we need to look elsewhere. And it's time that we stop buying into this propaganda that the best way to be a good person is to get a degree. That's completely irrelevant to what you plan on doing with your life. So I hope that this realization sinks in sooner or later. And I'll gladly go out of business when we finally make progress towards becoming a more productive society and then a more reflective society for that matter.
I have one more question about what we were saying earlier. I guess with the issue of the ethical issue, I understand the issue is about undermining a corrupt system, but what would your response be to people who say that what you're doing puts students who write their own papers at a disadvantage? What do you say to that argument?
That is absolutely true. But these students, well, we do not need to worry about these students because students who truly are responsible and industrious will be fine in life. And chances are most of these students do not major in worthless crap that continues to dominate the collective culture of the university. I regret that I'm undermining the hard working and responsible students, but unfortunately, they're a tiny minority who do not represent the general attitudes of the student body. And I hope that sooner rather than later that this system comes crumbling down, where most students will actually be responsible and hardworking. But hopefully that's going to happen within the next decade.
So, Alex, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you. Glad.
That was Alex from Academic Composition. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.